this is an interview with Judge Luskovansky for the Youngstown State University Law School Graduates Project by Paul Carlson at the courthouse on 6 May 1977 at 10:05 in the morning. Judge Luskovansky, could you tell us something about your background?
I have a rather varied background. You want to begin from birth?
That's right.
I was born in Senecaville, Ohio, 28th March 1925. Senecaville, Ohio is located in the south central part of the state. Cambridge is a near large city, and Senecaville is located at now Senecaville Dam, which a lot of people use for recreational purposes, part of the Muskingum Conservatory District, I believe. And we moved here to Youngstown when I was probably a year old. Dad, at the time I was born, was a coal miner, came here from Europe, and married my mother here in the USA. So that I've been, you might say, a lifelong resident of Youngstown, except for that first year, of which memory is nil, none. Then I attended the schools here at St. Matthias School, grades 1 through 8, Woodrow Wilson High School, 9 through 12. Went to the service in the Navy, and came home from the Navy, went to work at the Sheet and Tube. I started the college, Youngstown State. It wasn't Youngstown State then, it was Youngstown College, 1948, and went full-time liberal arts school, and eventually went to Ohio Northern to law school for the first year, and I was married in the meantime in 1948. Things got a little close financially, and so my wife was here while I was away at Northern at the end of the first year of law school at Ohio Northern. Financially was unable to continue, so I got a job and worked for the state of Ohio as a factory building inspector and pursued my education until I graduated in 1953 and was admitted to the bar, and then was appointed first assistant prosecutor in the administration of Mayor Frank Crisen, where I stayed for some period of time until I was given a promotion to the first assistant law director's job of the city of Youngstown, which is the trial lawyer for the city. And I stayed there through Mayor Crisen's administration and Mayor Franco's administration, and was then appointed municipal judge in December of 61, and was subsequently elected to two terms, and eventually sought the job of domestic relations judge here in Mahoning County.
Just tell us a little bit more about your family. You mentioned your father was a coal miner.
My dad came here from Europe and went to work in the coal mines. His educational background, some people wonder about the fact that I went to college and eventually received a law degree, which is university training. My dad went to work in the iron ore mines in Slovakia when he was 6 years old, and at that time that's when people went to work, and the school they went to would be a parish school, a church school if you please, when they had time, when the educational circumstances permitted. But and it's interesting to note that this man was literate, could read very well, read Slovak, was able to read and write, and eventually gained some command, certainly a understanding of English, although as most of our first generation people in those days, they were very reticent to speak it because different from today, I think, in America. We're much more tolerant than they used to be. Today, if some of our fellow citizens or some of our visitors here don't speak with a clear enunciation of what we deem to be American English, we enjoy it, tolerate it, and perhaps really are interested and listen much more closely. In the old days, I know what used to happen. They used to laugh at them. They used to call them greenhorns and hunkies and dummies. But my dad did understand English and was able to speak some and was able to read English. So that was his educational background. My mother was a daughter of parents who had 13 children. The last child was born when the father had been deceased. They lived on a farm near Cambridge, Ohio, near the town of Byesville. And they were rather hit hard by the Depression, and the girls used to take turns going to school, and the boys used to take turns going to school because there were only two sets of clothes that the children could wear to school. So Mom never got past, I believe, the seventh grade. And that's my mom and dad's educational background. They were very deeply devoted religious people. I would say that my dad's life was centered around about the church and family, obviously devoted to work. And my mother was very much the same way, although she was born here in the United States of America and was 10 years younger than my dad.
What were your parents' names?
Susan Younger Luskovansky, and of course Stephen.
Could you tell us more about some of your early experiences?
Well, if you want to go back through grade school, as I had already indicated to you, that my parents' life was centered around about the church and family. Of course, naturally, it was centered around us, and our attentions were devoted to church and school and home. But perhaps this is some part of America that a lot of people like to forget about. I was a youngster when we had the Depression, and I could recall days that there wasn't too much to eat, and I very clearly recall standing around Adams School in a soup line and hoping that the fellow would reach down with the spoon to the bottom of the pot and give us some goodies instead of just the soup on the top. I can recall in the morning we used to get mother's oats, and then we could go and get soup and a loaf of bread. And there weren't big breads, and it wasn't enough to go around, but I can recall that. I can recall where we didn't have shoes to wear, and we all went barefoot, except for when we were going to church. this is a side of America which people want to forget. But I think it's a very important side of America to remember, because today, when America is so generous and gives of herself to the whole world, of course, when America needed help, everyone says, well, there was no help to be given. But if you recall a few years ago when one of our Canadian friends wrote some lyrics and a poem, which was played quite a bit around this country, I enjoyed that. Of course, I have a lot of Canadian friends, and maybe it was for that reason, but it also made me think about the fact that someone finally recognized that the American heart has always been generous, whereas some of the rest of the world has never been generous to America, except, of course, for the early generosity which was displayed by France, and that was not perhaps a real generous nature. Maybe they had an ulterior motive when they did that, but nevertheless, we did receive the benefits of some of those people's efforts. I don't know, I could probably expound on these ideas for hours, but and I don't know how I got from my parents all the way to the American Revolution, but that's my way of relating, and how I got to the Depression, because I'm sure you never heard of the Depression, or you may have heard somebody refer to it obliquely. But to stand on that hot pavement in the afternoon with that my dad's old miner's pail, see, most of the people would come there with pots and pans, and those of us, and there were an awful lot of people in this neighborhood who were miners. And all of their, you could tell the miners' pails because they were made of aluminum. Good, strong, sturdy, thick aluminum, which you couldn't buy that kind of a bucket today. Not just because they don't manufacture it, but because of the good quality aluminum which was made. And of course they made those with aluminum because it was necessary to take down the coal mines so that they didn't rust. And one of the things that kind of sticks out in my mind was the fact that the aluminum would wear, and the hinged handle that used to go with it would sometimes fall for people. So the whole deal was to find someone who was able to get a good copper rivet to replace the old worn steel rivets which were used in those, or some of the pails had aluminum rivets, so that then you wouldn't lose your mother's oats and lose your soup on the way home. I don't know, I want to talk some more about the young days. What did I do? All right, I went to school. I of course had to study, because if you didn't study, that was a beating coming. We had a very strict regimen at home. I was an altar boy, which was, I think, a very important part of my life. It helped form some of my thinking because it exposed me to the clergy, to the priest, and I was able to talk and visit with people who had a lot more education than my parents did. We grew up, obviously, in a rather closely knit community, because in those days, communities were knit with ethnic and religious backgrounds being very determinative of where people lived. I see that's interfering quite a bit. Mary Beth, she'll get that for you. Catch the door. And my neighborhood on the south side of Youngstown, which is commonly called Lansingville, was very representative of a ethnic, religious-oriented community. And some people in those days used to call it Holy Hill. And everybody went to church. Everybody observed holidays. And we did have some people who were not Catholic, but we talk about religious tolerance. Every one of us understood and tolerated each other's views and why they were. And in those days, that was kind of a really ecumenical situation, because in some neighborhoods they didn't. But with still the fact that there was a religious difference, almost all the people were of the same cultural background, too, with Slav. We had some few Italians who lived in our neighborhood. Growing up, I did the usual things, played on the street, baseball. No one would think about doing that today. 3 feet off the mud gutter and hide and seek. Put your finger on a telephone pole. If there was a nail in it, you can get the tickling sensation of electricity flowing down. Youngsters wouldn't know about that today. We played down what was at that time known as Pine Hall Park. We used to swing in a vine like Tarzan of the Apes. There were some caves down there that we used to explore, which were explored every day by the same group of people. And we'd build a fire in a cave, and I still recall a place we called Devil's Cave, which is very representative of that which is depicted in some pictures, as you see the picture of the caveman with a flat rock and trees and the forest growing overhead, and a rather concave formation at the bottom of the cave, and we'd have a fire there, and some of us would bring some bacon from home or whatever food, and then would roast it over this fire. But a piece of bread, this was a real big experience. This was our way of entertaining ourselves. I could go on and on, but I suppose maybe. Well, we did play baseball day after day after day. That was one of the greatest things that there was. Every day there was a ball game. Yes, ma'am. They're ready to start. Okay. Please. I'm leaving this here because I have to. I'm going to make a couple phone calls.
Yeah, I think the last thing you were talking about was playing baseball.
Yep. And that was a big thing in our day. Perhaps I ought to amplify. In those days, everybody had a league, except the little people, boys. And different from today, we could never get to play on the ball field, shitty run ball field. We used to be relegated to playgrounds, streets, and wherever empty lots we could find. And certainly contrasting that with today, where the youngsters have all the places made for them and have all kind of uniforms and all kinds and types of equipment, makes someone perhaps a little bit envious, jealous, and reminds us again of our very humble beginnings. Okay.
Sir.
Well, I suppose I keep on talking about baseball day after day, because that did involve quite a bit of our youthful activity, but perhaps that's enough.
Okay, could you tell us something about your schooling? What type of, were you a good student, or did studies play an important part in your early life?
In my early life, I was regarded as an excellent student. I would say that my studying ability declined for a little bit, as most boys do when they get closer to girls and so on and so forth. But in my early days, I can recall my first grade report card, 49 A's, 19 B's, and 2 C's. It didn't continue on that way. I was an A student probably the first 6 or 7 years of my life, except that I was never very good at math. And math is one of the subjects which probably kept me from ever becoming an engineer, because I'm so interested in mechanical and structural things. And I suppose I relate that to society, and that's the reason I generally try to dissect society and analyze it, because I'm so interested in machines. And I still am interested in machines, still repair. Do a lot of repairs on my own automobiles and my wife's automobiles and my daughter's automobiles, and repair lawnmowers and do all the chores around about that people don't know about. Of course, that's the way I worked my way through school, by being a mechanic. And I had a lot of jobs, but you're not on that category yet. If you want me to run to that category, I could probably start off by telling you I used to peddle groceries from P.H. Butler store, which are no longer in existence. And sold a lot of newspapers. In those days, we used to wait for extras. And I helped a family of boys with their newspaper route. We had what was probably 2/3 of the area. Well, we used to cover all of Lansingville, plus part of Cochran Park, plus part of the area of Alexander, and all the streets in that area. So those were the early jobs, of course, and I would help my neighbor repair automobiles. He did a bit of that. Eventually I got a job in the Hughes Provision, and I believe I started there at the magnanimous sum of 35 cents an hour, which is much advanced from some of the other people. And I used to sell hog maws, chitterlings, sauerkraut, liver, next to the fish counter there. Eventually I received some promotions there. I think I got up to about 45 or 50 cents an hour. I can recall I used to walk to work sometimes, didn't have the bus pass, because Dad would be riding the pass to work, and I'd walk down, walk back. I can recall we used to knock off for lunch, but it was on our own time, and we would clean the butcher shop at the end of the day, all on our own time, counters, floor, the whole thing. Of course, we were very happy to be able to get a job. I eventually attended some gas stations and worked in those areas. I When I got to high school, I did have a job with the bus company. During the war, during my time in high school, the war was on and they needed mechanics. And so I worked there a little bit, but prior to that, I did a lot of work. I used to run cars up and down a ramp here. It was Youngstown Garage, which is now the downtown garage, and I worked for a gentleman with whom I, even to this day, maintain a very good relationship. I'm very proud of it because he was a real good boss. And one of the first men under whose immediate direction I worked was a Negro gentleman who just recently died, Clarence Dent. And between Mr. Dennison, the gentleman whom I referred to who was the manager at a downtown garage, and Mr. Les Donnell, who's one of the greater known business entrepreneurs in our community, and I, we for years used to visit this gentleman on New Year's Day because that was his birthday. And I mention this in job light to show how sometimes from job situations you do develop friends, and I did. After I left the downtown garage, I did go to the work for the bus company. I had taken that out of order. Eventually, I went to work for the sheet and tube. But once, I suppose this is a confession, the summer before I worked, I was old enough, when I was 16, I went to work at Republic Steel Corporation. I had a cousin whose name is John Leskovansky, but he was John Francis Leskovansky. And I took his baptismal certificate down and sort of kind of badged our way into the Republic Steel Corporation when we were 16. Sort of kind of told a lie. And it's the job I had down there. I was a steel rigger in the Republic. And eventually, after I left there that summer because of some safety dispute, I went to work to Canton for a gas station, Mallory Oil Company. And I had a good experience there. I lived with my aunt and uncle, and it gave me an insight as to how a person, I suppose, learns to live alone and depend upon oneself. I have a half a cup again. When that was between my visit to Kent, was between my junior and my senior year in school. And the oil company that I was working for, Mallory Oil Company at that time, desired me to stay there because I had taken a gas station which they were about to close and brought it up to, I guess they were selling about 8 or 10 times more gasoline than they were selling there, doing service work, doing grease jobs and all types, kinds and types of repairs. And so then they were took me from that station, took me down to the main station because I displayed some ability, and they had a truck service area there. And again, this was during the war, and so they were short of people experienced or knowledgeable or desirous of work for whichever reason. And I received money that way. Eventually, they were about to put me on the road as a salesman for oil, calling upon a number of large companies. But I did come back for my senior year and finished high school. When I came back for my senior year, I went to work at Sheet and Tube. I first went to work there in the Mason Labor Gang, which is probably the toughest way to break into a steel mill, because the first thing that you do there, my first night of work there, I'll never forget. I came down in a thin pair of pants and a shirt, and probably the thinnest pair of shoes a lad ever had. They gave me a pair of wooden shoes to put on. I had a new pair of gloves, and they took and put a steel ball on top of a open hearth furnace, which they had just got through tapping the turn before. And then they said, okay, boys, go in there and throw the brick out so they could rebuild the furnace. And it was still hot, very hot. And the bricks you couldn't take up with your gloves. You had to use some asbestos gloves, which they wouldn't do that job that way today. But it was, they first tried to have us go in and burn up our own hot mill gloves, then eventually when our gloves were burned up, no one cared too much about the skin or the rest of the people. Go and throw the brick out of there. Then you'd get a job also, which was cleaning the checkers, which is also regarded as a very nasty job. You'd go down into the area where the flue dust would collect. And I don't think today, under OSHA standards, one could work there as we did without respirators or anything and stay in that heat and that absolute dry heat and dust. There would be a lot of graphite floating around in the air. So after some effort and some of the men in the steel mill, knowing that I'd worked as a rigger at Republic and had some experience in that area, knew how to splice cable and knew a little bit about that sort of kind of work, I was transferred over to the rigging department of sheet and tube, and I stayed there until I graduated from high school. And I graduated from high school and went to the service, the United States Navy, on the 17th, I believe, June, somewhere thereabouts. We were sworn in, then I had to leave a week or two and went reported to Great Lakes Naval Training Center. At Great Lakes Naval Training Center, we received what's known as boot camp. And of course, that's another period of history, but during my service in the Navy, I did become a motor machinist, made first class. Eventually, I did come back to sheet and tube and went to work in a garage department. They wanted me to go back in the rigging department, but I didn't do that. I went to work in a garage department, from whence I quit to go to college. And when I quit to go to college, I went down as a part-time worker, and it was a very demeaning proposition because a week before I was acting as a gang leader and giving people tractors to use in a coal strip mill, and the foreman were my bestest friends because it was up to me to repair a tractor or let them have a tractor. And a week later, I'll never forget this one gentleman who eventually was beaten by a number of people who worked there who wouldn't give me the turns. We used to come out and stand around and hope that they'd give us a job. And he'd pick all his friends and give them a job, and he'd send me home, showed me my pants were too clean, no use getting them dirty, go on back home. I needed to work very bad because I was married, we had a child, and I was really hurt. But it was a real come down, and sort of kind of made me remember about life and some things like you don't really forget. One day a hero, next day a heel. And I part-timed at the sheet and tube for many, many years, all the way through a liberal arts school and until I did get to, as I say, a full year of law school. Then I went to work for the state of Ohio as a factory and building inspector. My qualifications for the job, of course, were the fact that I did know about structural rigging and knew about construction work from being a rigger. But I learned quite a bit about the diverse interests of building and safety. And even to this day, I maintain a great big safety interest because it did play a big part in my life in those days. And I like to think that we did render a service. I was regarded as perhaps a rather strict inspector. I was kind of proud of the fact that I never went to lunch with any of the people that I ever inspected. And the respect which I gained from both the industry and the construction labor people maintains till this date. Many of the people who were business agents in those days who have gone on and who have retired and still maintain a very great social friendship with me. And I think that helped demonstrate to me the benefit of doing your job, doing it the best way you know how, showing no favoritism, and gaining the respect of the people that you work with, not because you're doing them favors, but because you're doing your job. And I always like to think that that's one of the things that has helped me to do my job as judge. going along, I suppose we ought to continue with the fact that as I graduated from law school, I left the state building inspection department. Incidentally, I was at that time considered and was offered the job of being assistant director of industrial relations of the state of Ohio, because I gained some skills in inspection, and because of my law school training, I obviously was able to read and understand the requirements and requisites of the job better than perhaps some of the other people who had more building trades experience than I did. But rather than go to Columbus and involved in that situation, I took the job as first assistant prosecutor, which paid about, I guess, $4,000 or $5,000 a year less. But I stayed in Youngstown with my family. And as I say, I already indicated that I went from the prosecutor's job to the first assistant law director job, eventually was appointed judge. And
right.
Here I am. No use repeating that.
I just read quite a few Vindicator articles about that, and you were making, as first assistant law director, you were making $5,639, and then when your promotion went to $8,117.
How about that? That's interesting, because I obviously can't remember, and I couldn't recall what the difference was. I think the job of director of industrial relations at that time was in the $13,000 category, and I was being talked about as $9,500 or $10,000. And I took the difference in the salary and stayed here.
About your years in the liberal arts school up here at the college, Youngstown College, what stands out in your mind about that period? Good?
Catch.
Just wondering how the courses up here went.
Oh, okay, my Youngstown College days. The thing I suppose I remember the most is the fact that I worked and went to school, and I met so many nice people, and I still recall some of them, and something that you youngsters today wouldn't know about, we had a lot of barracks on the campus. And I suppose the great social highlights were the fact that there were always a group of us that were willing to study together, and always a group of us that would go to the cafeteria and study and then take a break by playing some cards, some different kind of cards, pinochle or whatnot, never for money. Always enjoying each other's pleasant sociability. And I'd like to say this, during those times, and you understand most of us were GIs, and some of the gals were younger and some of the gals were our age. I wasn't aware of any, you might call, on campus or off campus petting or social sexual situations which one would perhaps which one is exposed to now. I would like to characterize my time at Youngstown and the people I associated with as being very, very interested in study. If I could tell you that we would not only study during the day, but we would meet and study in the evening in a library or whatever place was made available to us, they'd close down a cafeteria. We would study in empty rooms. We'd find out that a room was empty at a certain time and we'd get together and really study. If I were able to devote the time that we spent to analyzing and understanding our courses now to perhaps life, I would certainly be an expert. Now, the studies that we did, I suppose we worked against ourselves because most of the professors graded on a curve. And those people who didn't study just couldn't survive. I think the attrition rate should have been much higher, but I think the professors graded on a prejudice curve in some cases. They would take some of our groups and certainly would get A's and B's. But there would be an awful lot of people who would get these low C's simply because the professors were making allowances for those of us who really worked real hard. I suppose the difference is, and the reason was, that a lot of us were ex-GIs, that's what they call us in those days. We were GIs, and we were very serious about life and realized that we'd given up some of our years to activities which I think enhanced our educational background, but certainly not the formal type of education which we were trying to amass or retain at Youngstown. So we were a very studious group. Our social amenities were reduced to a minimum in the manner that we have today. I would say we would attend one or two or three dances a year, which would be about all. There was not much on-campus activity in those days. People were very busy. I remember some outstanding instructors. Of course, I was assistant to Dr. Riley. Dr. Riley is still there. I graded papers for Dr. Riley and did a lot of work for him. And I suppose I have so many fond memories of people there, but Doc always sticks out in my mind, and I suppose with a bit of a guilt complex, because I've never taken the time to develop a deeper friendship than we had at that time, and to expand on it now that I've been busy, but our paths are so different. I can recall Mr. Schultz, and I can recall so many, it's almost totally unfair to talk about one professor when they were all so outstanding. I think listening to our children talk about their instructors and professors at the school today, I think, and this is not being nice perhaps, but I think the quality of teaching has somewhat suffered. It seemed that in those days, those professors had a very deep personal interest in people, seeing that they got it, seeing that they understood it, and were always willing to give you that little extra help if you needed it. Of course, maybe it was because we displayed so much interest, but the staff at the university, at the college at that time, was tremendous. They were very devoted to their students and wanted Youngstown to excel. I think that was the whole thing. Youngstown was a small, independent college, and everyone who was associated with it wanted it to excel. And I suppose that's the reason it worked so well. I don't know, we could probably talk about a lot of other things, but we had one thing I'd like to talk about, and a positive and negative factor. Dr. Carl Dykema, who was regarded as one of the giants at the university and in American literature and language, was a professor with whom I had very violent disagreements. Dr. Dykema talked to a course, I took a course from him in summer school, which really sharpened up our disagreements, because his basic philosophy and mine, I could see the differences there. And as you probably don't know, but Dr. Dykema was credited with being the man in America in literature and in grammatical education who was the proponent of the idea that let us forget the formal matters of grammar and English and all those necessary things. Let's see if we can't communicate. In other words, perhaps using some which might be called slang language. But Dr. Dykema didn't too much believe, or impressed us with the fact that he didn't too much believe with diagramming sentences and punctuation marks and all those formal things. I disagreed with the doctor in that area, and I disagreed with him about the philosophy of life. About that time, I was already spending time in some law offices, Mr. Beatrice, and watching and listening to what was happening, and I made many visits, as life would have it, to domestic relations court and listened to what was being said. And in those days, the judge didn't hold court as I do in a courtroom. He held court back in his chambers. And the people would come in very quietly. This was a surreptitious thing that was carried on. And so I had to gain the confidence of the judge and everybody else in order to be able to listen. And the things that came out in Anakin or Nina and the and all these different old philosophies about why people didn't live together and so on and so forth weren't holding true from what I could hear, from what I could see in court. So, although I respected him for his views and his ideas, he and I disagreed rather sharply. But in spite of our disagreements, and this was the beauty part of it, and I suppose the reason I'd like to mention Dr. Dykema, we did hold a respect for each other. And this was important. I gather today that's not quite true. Of course, I'm judging not from my own experience, but from what I hear from some of the other students today, which is not a high rating for our educational system. And of course, you don't want to hear me about that because I think our educational system stinks, especially our public educational system. I know that's strong language to have down there for posterity, but I use it when I talk in public, wherever I speak. I think our educational system is very devoid of the necessary requirements for our people to understand about America. The very interruption that we had here a few moments ago for young people who were coming in during Law Day and Law Week, that very interruption is proof of the fact of what I state. And people come here from various grades and from various schools. When I was in municipal court, we had the same thing occur. One of the things which teachers and instructors do is bring children around and show them some of the governmental functions in our community. And if they came to my courtroom, I would visit them, I'd give them an opportunity to see a real-life judge with the robe on, have the bailiff open court so that they would get the flavor of the fact that this still is a formal thing and we carry on that which some people regard as archaic, the fact that the bailiff opens court by saying, "Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye, this court is open," etc., etc., etc. But I would then begin to talk about the youngsters, about our Constitution, and about our three branches of government. And it's very, very disappointing to know that there are seniors graduating from high school who don't know that. They're the products of a public educational system. John Q. Citizen pays for it. It's very disheartening for me to see young America not know why America. All the history courses which we have today apparently don't give the emphasis, and maybe I'm wrong in this area, they don't seem to generate in our people the spirit of appreciation of why America. And I don't mean just getting up and waving the flag, but the ideological and the philosophical propositions which bring about government and how government functions. And it's for this reason that I severely criticize our educational system. I think it's atrocious. If this government, which makes this educational system possible, can't be understood by the people who receive the benefits therefrom, it reminds me a little bit of the rest of today's philosophy. The respect for parents and a respect for family and a respect for home apparently are somewhat degenerated. And yet, the youngsters still demand. I didn't say expect. I said demand all of the things which they think their parents should give them. And so we do the same thing with society, which brings us down to the basic proposition that if we understood our Constitution, if we understood the fact that our Constitution gives us a lot of privileges, but again, it also imposes upon us a lot of responsibilities, I think the entire philosophy of not only our country, but of our moral, economic, and our political system would change considerably. So that's the reason I said our educational system stinks.
Judge, I'd like to ask you, when did you get the inkling that you want to go to law school? Was that always in the back of your mind?
Always in the back of my mind was the idea that I'd like to be a lawyer. But I never thought I'd have the time, the devotion, or the ability to go forth because I realized that it cost a lot of money. And so when I first went to college, I thought that I would do the next thing, which I thought I'd like to do, was to be a foreign correspondent. So I was going to go to journalism. I almost went to Kent State. As a matter of fact, at the end of my freshman year, I had prepared a transfer to Kent State. One of my friends and myself prepared to do that, but I just didn't quite get around to it. And after I talked, you see, I got married at the end of my freshman year of college, and I talked about it with my then wife, and she says, well, if you want to be a lawyer, why don't you just keep going to school? I said, well, because it takes too long. Well, she was a nurse, and she says, I'm willing to work if you're willing to go to school. So I then went on to be a lawyer. Well, that's, I always wanted to be a lawyer. I always admired lawyers, I suppose, from the early days when I first heard some of them talk at the church breakfasts and things of that nature. I was impressed with their idea to present philosophy and ideas. They were probably, next to the priest and the sisters who taught at our school, probably the only learned people I came much in contact with. Other than the school teachers, of course.
This might have been a mistake in the indicator, but did you go to the University of Alabama Law School also? And
I have attended courses at quite a number. After I graduated from law school, I didn't quit, and I still haven't quit. I suppose there is a story, there is a maxim, which says the law is a jealous mistress. I can still recall the dean of Ohio Northern saying that to us, and I thought at that time that the poor dean just didn't know what he was talking about, but he certainly did. Yes, I've attended many courses since I have graduated from law school. At Western Reserve, I took quite a number of medical legal courses there. At the University of Alabama, I took some courses down there, and I've attended numerous seminars. But lately, it seems, since I've become the domestic relations judge here, immediately after my first exposition to a domestic relations seminar, I've been giving seminars in this area. And I still try to keep up with the rules of evidence and some of our criminal procedures and some of our probate procedures. In other words, law, which is not utilized in my court. So yes, I did attend other schools. I would say that my trips to Western Reserve, for a couple of years there were a group of us who continued on and studied at Western Reserve. We studied the anatomy, the brain, the back. We took many medical legal courses, and a number of them were taught by the man who was the expert witness in the case which convicted the famous doctor from Cleveland, don't you see? Dr. Gerber was one of the instructors there. We're getting too far afield, though.
Yes, could you tell us more about your experience at Youngstown's Law School?
At Youngstown's Law School? Certainly. Being a part-time law school, being a night law school, being taught by only one full-time professor and the rest being practicing lawyers. Well, first of all, similar to what I had described at Youngstown College, during my undergrad days, similar to that, everybody who was in the law school was involved in some other field, working hard and studying real hard. I suppose, to tell you how hard we studied, there are a number of us, and we still have pictures of now Attorney Lawrence Damore, Attorney Donald L. Hanni, Attorney Walter Stoner, Attorney Anthony Gribus, and Attorney Lynn Bernard, literally breaking in to the old barracks law library window on Sunday mornings after church so that we could study and make our reviews. And the president obviously knew about this because we'd come and park our cars, and the Prexy could see our cars parked in the parking ground and would break in. Eventually, they came around and where the building custodian sort of kind of saw that we were able to find a key so we didn't have to push the window in the study. But later on, as I took a couple of fishing trips with Dr. Jones, he said, "Yeah, I knew you guys were breaking in there." He says, "How do you think eventually you guys got so you didn't have to break in? They come around and open the building for you guys." He says, "But you weren't breaking in to do any harm, so why in the devil should I holler about it?" We had some obviously outstanding people who taught at the school, and the regimen there was either you got it or you hit the road. I think it was a good law school as law schools go. Having attended full-time law school down at Ohio Northern and comparing it with Youngstown, I would say that, of course, I would say perhaps I was exposed to probably two of the best. Youngstown was regarded as the best night law school, at least if you were to take and see the number of people who were able to pass the bar examination, and the way law schools are rated is to the number of their graduates which are able to pass the bar after they get through school. There are an awful lot of law schools who have a high mortality rate when it comes time for bar examinations for the students. Youngstown had the highest rating in the state of night law schools consistently, and of course Ohio Northern consistently had the highest or next to the highest rating as to its students that passed the bar. One year, when there were less than 49% of the people who took the state bar examination that passed, Ohio Northern had the highest percentage of all the schools combined in the state. So I was exposed to the best in the full-time law school and in the part-time law school. And as I contrasted our experience here at Youngstown and Knight Law School with perhaps Akron or Cleveland or Franklin Marshall or wherever around about the state, I would have to feel certainly that our quality, the quality of our student and the quality of our professor and the regimen which was maintained there was a very high one. And I'm not saying that because you know, we graduated, we made the grade, but if you're asking me, and I'm rating you in the manner in which one would try to, and I'm doing it rather objectively, I think, and I hope. And the statistics ought to be able to bear me out.
Did you, do any of the instructors come to your mind?
Oh, sure. Clara Westenfield, Ray Falls, whom I saw die. Gosh, the most colorful one of them all. Died who smoked cigars. I think I can remember his name for the moment. It's embarrassing. God, how it's embarrassing. But I see his face in front of me. He was regarded as the fellow who had no favorites. The classical story about him was that when an attorney, a man who's now a judge, a county court judge in Ashtabula County, was the district manager of U.S. Steel, a fellow by the name of Brown, whose brother is Paul Brown, who is on the Ohio Supreme Court now, who is district manager of U.S. Steel, which is a big job, tried to walk in a classroom at 1 minute after seven when he closed the door. He threw him right out on his ear. He had no favorites. His name began with a K. God, it's embarrassing. I can't remember his name.
Knowles Wyatt.
Knowles Wyatt. Yeah, by God. Okay. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. He was regarded as an outstanding instructor. Of course, some of the people who taught me now come to my court, and that's somewhat embarrassing. Not embarrassing, but tips the scales a different way. I recall one of my evidence teachers, Mr. Newman, who comes to court here rather infrequently, but when he does and I rule on evidence, I sort of kind of look at him, give him a smile, and I kid him very graciously, he accepts, and I do, of course, because I mean it in that manner. I got a B, and I thought I should have got an A in that course, and sort of kind of tell him, well, now, you know, you just gave me a B, so now you got to get to Gorg. But, well, we had, I could go down, almost all the instructors, which sounds funny because I could remember Mr. Wyatt's name, but yes, they're all practicing lawyers here. Most of them are still alive, but Ray Falls was a gentleman who was a real gentleman. He was the dean at that time, and Clara Westenfield, who was the full-time professor, but he also taught political science, and I did study political science from him, and I always credit him with being the guy responsible for my getting into politics. Because when I was taking political science from him and taking the course, he insisted that we come down to city council and watch it operate. And that's when sprung my idea of politics. He became the dean of the law school, and he taught us a number of courses in the law school.
Were you well prepared for the bar exam?
A group of us that studied for the bar exam took the review course in Cleveland, known as a Winer-Minor course. We took turns driving, and I already mentioned our crew. Of course, Tony Gravis didn't take the exam with us. But Don Hanni, Larry Damar, Walter Stoner, and yours truly went back and forth from Youngstown to Cleveland twice a week, took the bar exam, took that review course. Eventually, that was known as the long course, then it was a short course, a 2 weeks course. Through Arseny Melnick, a group of us stayed at Dr. John Melnick's, that which is now Dr. John Melnick's fraternity house for the summer. They were so happy to have us rent the place and sort of kind of watch it. We went there for 2 weeks, and if you ever saw, I guess there were about 10 or so of us or 12 of us there, but we each maintain our own groups. If you ever saw 10 or 12 people more devoted to study than we were, our daily regimen was of getting up possibly around, some of us got up earlier than others, but getting up around 5:30, 6 o'clock and reviewing the things that we were going to go downtown to review, getting prepared to be able to assimilate that which they were going to throw at you. We went down to the studies that they offered us, the review course that they gave us. We'd come back, eat, and then we would review that which they reviewed and begin to review the matters of tomorrow. And very rarely did we ever hit the sack before 11 or 12 o'clock at night. Yeah, we really studied. We were, I think, as prepared for the bar as anybody. The tragedy of my time at the bar was that at the end of my first day at the bar, I ran into a fellow who was eventually playing an important part in my life, one Mike DeSell. Ran into him and the fellow I worked with in Department of Industrial Relations, Ed Fink. And we were staying at the Seneca Hotel rather than at one of the larger downtown hotels for two reasons. One, I knew everybody around downtown Columbus from having worked for the state. And two, it was a little bit cheaper. So I walked in the Seneca Hotel at the end of my first day of writing the bar exam, and I ran into Mike DeSell and Ed Fink. And Mike says to me, "Why, John, how about a drink?" "No, sir, Mike, I'm down here taking a bar exam. I can't afford to take a drink, you know." "Oh," he says, "geez, that's the very thing you need." He says, "How do you feel?" He says, "I don't know, boy, I didn't come up with questions." And I took the paper out of my pocket and I'm starting to try to prove to him that, you know, what I knew and what I didn't know about the questions. And he laughed it off and he ordered me a Manhattan. I drank some Manhattans in those days, and they proceeded to get me drunk. And at the end of the first day of the bar, that night, when we were going out to eat, I was drunk. I got up the next morning about 4 o'clock, sick, miserable, hurting. Decided that I'd better do what I was supposed to do anyway. Got up and showered, shaved, and cleaned up, went to church. One of the things we did every day, we went to church. So I was down bright and early to church that morning, down in Columbus, that which is the cathedral. And I walked in that day, and I don't think I understood anything till about, and that was a long day. The second day of taking a bar was a long day. I think I didn't write anything on my paper till around 10:30. We were in there at 9 o'clock. I spent an hour and a half being in a restroom, trying to get some fresh air, trying to clear the cobwebs of mine off my mind, fearful to write because I didn't trust myself. So I must have been well prepared for the bar because I survived that and eventually did pass. Which, one bit of advice, when you go down and take the bar exam, don't drink.
Did you have a favorite course that you were most interested in law school up at the university, or?
I guess the course that I was the most interested in law school was the course that Don Hanna and I did the most work in. The business courses, corporations and partnerships. Don and I took the trouble to outline those two courses. And we made outlines which we proliferated around about the state. Our outlines were in great demand at Ohio State, Ohio Northern, anywhere in the state of Ohio, because he and I diagrammed that as best one could. Don loved to write and I loved to argue. And he had beautiful handwriting and no one could read mine. And so just because he had the chance eventually to finish writing it, I suppose was the reason he and I did it. And we argued and fought then as we do now. So those were, I suppose, our favorite courses. I still thought my best course was evidence, although I only got a B in it. And the joke of it is, of course, that I never got a chance to use much of the business courses, although I did represent some commercial clients, but certainly not as many as I did in personal injury and probate work.
Why do you think the law school was closed?
Basically, because the lawyers in Youngstown wanted it closed, because they felt that they were creating too much competition. That's the reason the law school at Youngstown was closed. I don't think that's a secret. I don't think that's even debatable. The way it came around, the way it was brought about, was they put the squeeze on the budget and said, well, we can't afford any full-time professors and you guys just don't go teach. I think it was a bad thing. I would certainly think that, and like to think that because of the quality, and if you look around our community, you look around the state, some of those lawyers who were produced, they've been really good lawyers. And some would say we produce some giants in the law field. Well, we'd never produce the Harvard graduates or these graduates that come from Columbia or Yale, whom I don't think are as good as some of the rest of us are. But law school is a little bit like buying name brand clothes, you know. If you went to Harvard or Yale, immediately you're set aside in a category. If you went to a small time law school, the big firms, first of all, don't want to touch it because the big employers, the big retainers don't come in for people like that. And in government work, it's if you say, well, you went to Youngstown College of Law, the President of the United States wasn't too interested in appointing you to some cabinet position. But if you went to Harvard or Yale, even though you were just a mediocre, all of a sudden you become a giant. I think it was a mistake to close Youngstown Law School because of the quality of people it produced.
Do you be in favor of them reestablishing a law school?
Absolutely. Absolutely. One of my sons wanted to get into law school, couldn't get into law school because the the standards which they set up for getting into law school are high. Good, fine, they should be. Now, but I want to say this at the outset. The boys' point average was a 3.4, okay? That wasn't good enough to get into law school. They went 3.6s, and a lot of law schools were taking just people above 3.8. And one of the, why? Because for 210 openings in a freshman class, they had 22 or 23 or 2,400 applicants. Certainly some of them were doubles. Certainly some of them were doubles. But the point is, There were just too many people who wanted to go in the field of law. And one of these days, we're going to find that our law schools and our lawyers are going to, we're going to be in the same situation that we are now with our doctors. Our doctors restricted the medical schools, and so we have today a proliferation of doctors from all over the world coming here and making a good living in our country. And this is not so wrong, but we denied the opportunity to so many of our own young people who were qualified. But we just said arbitrarily, hey, we ain't making no more, and it's wrong. I could go on about this medical school, but that's one of the things which I also have very strong opinions about, and tell you an experience about my neighbor who graduated from Ohio State, a straight A student, except C's for Jim because he had a gimpy knee, which he could do nothing about, and who couldn't get into Ohio State Medical School because he didn't have a brother, father, cousin, uncle, or anybody who'd go into Ohio State Medical School, didn't have any connections. And I could tell you that George Tablack, the father of the current representative, finally took the whole damn appropriation bill for Ohio State University and stuck it in his pocket and said, there'll be not a dime go to Ohio State University till they can tell me why this kid Nick Martin can't get into law school. That was, I suppose, my first real exposure to power politics and understanding how it's played. And eventually that lad got into law school, but he had to go to school for another year. Just marking time till he get into law school. You talk about discrimination, mister. That was discrimination. And you talk about people not being able to gain education. You talk about our country suffering because we don't have enough qualified people to operate it. Well, we do it with our own restrictive type of educational system. And when our professional people criticize our unions, they're just as damn bad as the unions are. Probably worse, because they rob people of their mind, whereas the unions only say, well, we're not going to let you work over here, you go work somewhere else. But these people don't permit the mind to be utilized. And I think we're familiar with one of the things that's said today by a certain group of people who seek money to, for educational purposes. They say a mind is a terrible thing to waste. Let's go on, I suppose, to something else because we're going to run out of time.
Yeah, I think you already answered my question on the ABA and the AMA that they're playing.
Why is it so necessary? I have not a thing against the people of India or the Philippines or where. Why is it so necessary that we have so many of those doctors here we didn't educate our own people? America wants to know that. Who do we blame? You know, I've already had the answer.
I think this is the hardest question that I'll be asking you, and you could probably fill a whole tape answering it. Maybe
I'll try to surprise you and see if I can't condense it, because I'm given to being verbose.
Okay. Well, one of the works that I read preparing me for these questions was by, I don't even have the sheet here, but it was by Common Pleas Judge Lois Foray in Philadelphia, and she wrote a book called The Death of Law. Published in 75. And she's more or less caught up in this anti-Watergate political feeling that's the mood of the people right now. The question is, do we live in a just society? Or she's claiming that we really don't. And of course it took her about 500 pages to explain why we don't live in a just society, and I'm asking you right now. And
I didn't read the book, and I'm going to be very brief in this area. We live in as just a society, in as just a society as our people allow it to be. We live in as just a society as our educational system has taught our people to understand, to expect, to support, to promote. Our educational system has not prepared our people for a just society. If we're going to get into semantics and diagram, some would like to say define, the word just, we could spend certainly more than the 500 pages that you talk about this judge who wrote the book. But I believe justice is expressed in our constitutional framework is being very jealously guarded by the few people, and I'm not saying this simply because I'm a judge, but by the few people who are entrusted with it, the judiciary. But I think the judiciary is getting a little bit tired, a little bit weak, a little bit weary, because John Q. Citizen doesn't seem to really always want it. Our business people, who are supposed to be the basic quality because of our economic philosophy, are not supportive in many instances of good judiciary and good justice. So, yes, we live in a just society. We live in as just a society as we want. If you want more, I can give you more, but I think if you're looking for a capsule situation, I think that does it. I think that tells you what I think. More importantly, why I think it.
Hey, in our attempt to get an overall picture of the graduates of the law school, I've been asking questions on current controversial issues. Would you mind if I ask you a few of them?
Go ahead.
Okay.
You understand, as a judge, I am somewhat limited in my public expressions, or I feel I should be. However, I have very regularly expressed myself in this educational field because I feel I should, and I have a right to, and I don't think my judicial duties should prohibit me from doing that. But go ahead and let's see what you have.
Well, I generally ask opinions on capital punishment. Maybe.
What do I think about capital punishment? Am I for it or against it?
Is it a deterrent to crime?
I think it is. Not in all crimes, but in some crimes it is. You see, the classical argument against capital punishment is, when a guy's mad and he wants to kill somebody, he kills them anyhow. He doesn't even think about the electric chair. In that case, nothing is a deterrent because the human mind isn't functioning. When you talk about a deterrent, you're talking about a functioning mind. And when you're talking about people who are angry, who've temporarily lost the complete, or at least a partial use of their mind, certainly, nothing's a deterrent. No matter what types of punishment are designed, whatever sanctions are imposed, those sanctions in some way, shape, or form deter activity. I think so. I am not saying to you that I'm for or against capital punishment. I say to you that, and I suppose I would be willing to take a stand, I can't see that capital punishment is so wrong. And of course, you can hearken back to the biblical proposition, you know, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And yes, we talk about the innocent people who were executed because the law has gone awry. And however, the law, I think, has a lot of preservatives in that area and protections. I would not take a stand against capital punishment. I suppose if you had to categorize me, you might say I'm for it, but there are propositions in capital punishment as being advocated by some today which I very much am consistent with, and some which I am inconsistent with. Okay?
Okay, what about the decriminalization of, say, marijuana?
The arguments for and against, again, I could probably recite better than some people, and I saw those earlier when I was on a municipal bench. I recanted them in those days. Most people like to compare it to alcohol and say, look, you legalize alcohol. Matter of fact, the state makes a lot of profit out of it, and alcohol blows the mind the same way that this does. Yes, sir. There's a lot of arguments to make against that proposition. But I don't think, and as we check around about our society, and I've done some work in alcoholism, have obviously here in domestic relations court and certainly municipal court, I saw the wreckage of society and that which was wreaked upon people because they became addicted to alcohol. Notice I use the term addicted. Yes, one could say that. But there are people who are able to tolerate alcohol, whose body has a tolerance for alcohol, and who do not become addicted thereto, who suffer perhaps very minimal or almost none. And no matter what you ingest into the human system, it's going to change the system some way, shape, or form, even the matter of proteins or fats or whatever. So when you say, well, as soon as you take the alcohol in, it degenerates something. Well, so do all the other things that we take into our system. But I am sure as you look around about our society, you can see people who take alcohol and who have, let's say, no ill effects within the parameter and the bounds which I've outlined right now. Whereas, I have yet to meet with people who began to take marijuana, dope, whatever kind, the drug situation, who have not suffered therefrom. And I'm one of those who thinks not just forbidding the sale on the street, not just permitting the people to have it because they want to use it, but I think our medical people give too many people too many drugs. I see, for example, young ladies coming in here for a divorce because of this trauma. They come in here and they are thoroughly and fully unable to comprehend what's going on because the doctors give them all these mental suppressants. Why? Because people don't want to face reality? I don't think that's an excuse to blow the mind. Again, a mind is a terrible thing to waste. And this marijuana and drugs certainly waste the mind. And I don't know what the relationship is, but it seems to me that it not only wastes the mind, it also affects some of the other parts of the body. I've yet to see the people who have been on drugs for a period of time whose eyesight is good, who don't have to walk around wearing different kinds and types of glasses. Decriminalization? Let me tell you, mister, obviously already by now you can see, I am not much in favor of, and I thoroughly disagree with the national people who advocate this. You know what we're saying? We're saying that this is not a crime of violence, so we're saying, let's not do this. But yet we want to prosecute the people who are involved in prostitution who harm nobody but themselves. And there's no permanent scar. We want to do the people who mess around with gambling. Ho! All the people stand up on Sunday morning and holler against it. And what do we hurt here? We hurt a pocket. Oh, then we go on to the derivative arguments. We hurt the family because a man gambled his whole pay away and the kid suffered. Now what happens when this kid of his who becomes addicted to air, marijuana and all these other different things and has to go down the street and bop somebody over the head in order to get the money for it? Sure, I know. If we make it so cheap that he can have it or we give it away to him for free, that's what he's going to have. But let me ask you this, those advocates who advocate the decriminalization. The People's Republic of China forbids any use of drugs. For centuries and for ages, the drug culture came from the East. And in China, those people, their sociologists who study this, and let's not just call them dumb or stupid because we don't understand them. They study too. They're producing a bomb the same way as we have. They've produced some modern technology that we're very much surprised because our news media taught us that they were backward and ignorant. Why did they come to the conclusion that this is no good? Why won't they give it to their citizens? And they had it for centuries. Why did they say it's no damn good, stop it? We could go on and on and on, but I think that suffices.
Yeah, just
One last question on current controversial issues was abortion, the abortion issue. Should a woman have the right to have an abortion if she feels, I guess this is individual rights.
Well, of course you come into the religious proposition there. The argument about abortion, for abortion, against abortion, centers down to what you believe. And there's no way that whatever law is fashioned or not fashioned is going to square with all of the various shades of religious belief in this area. And perhaps it's a way of saying, well, there's no solution to this problem. And there isn't. Because as long as you're going to allow people to have freedom of religion, as long as you're going to have people allow people to have their own philosophies and religion, you're going to have this. And the people who spend all this time trying to engineer our society to their own ideas are just a little bit wrong. I could tell you this. Look at the birth control that was practiced in France prior to World War II, World War I, you know. France practiced quite a bit of birth control. It was a Catholic, regarded as a Catholic country. The French didn't have enough people to get up and defend their country, did they? They had an aging society, and their people who were on retirement far overwhelmed the people who were in production. Look at India. India had an overpopulation, didn't it? Still was unable to defend itself. Now, I'm trying to show you, I'm trying to say, to prove my proposition that there's no solution in this area. I'm showing you the two
extremes.
Causes. And the people who go around about doing this, fine, they're doing a good job, they're interested in it, and whatever your church teaches you, that's what you're going to believe. And as long as you have freedom of religion, whatever, well, never mind, I'm repeating myself. Okay.
Just one last question, I guess. Your political experiences. I haven't asked you anything about that. I know.
Holy cow.
That could take a tape.
That would take a tape by itself. Suffice it to say, I already told you the basis of my political experiences occurred because Mr. Westmill sent me down to city council. I became a Democrat. I'm still a Democrat. However, when I was appointed to the bench by Governor DeSalle, the gentleman whom I earlier discussed with you as having got me drunk at the end of my first day of taking the bar examination, I was accused of going to become, because I was very active in partisan affairs. As a matter of fact, I was one of the vice presidents of the Democratic Party here in our community. And there were those who thought I would be a political judge. I think, since I have been on the bench, I think I've been accorded what I deem to be the highest honor of any other honors which I've received from a lot of people, and I'm very appreciative of those honors, is the fact that as lawyers come into my courtroom, they tell their clients, you're going to get a fair shake in there. So much so that I know sometimes one party or both parties, and I have never been asked to step aside. Once there was an indication that I might be asked, and I indicated I most certainly would, if people even have the feeling that there might be some pain or prejudice on my side or in my mind. But politics is an important facet of our society. I don't think enough people are involved in it. And there again, I'm very strongly opinionated. I don't think enough people participate in politics. And I think our press, certainly our press, make politics seem so bad and so dirty and so mean and so horrible, but yet it's the only form that we have for the people to express themselves. And I don't care if they're going to stand down there in the streets and holler for days at a time. There still has to be some regimen by which those loud shouts and those hollers and those screams are channeled and made to work. And it has to be some form of politics. I think we need a lot more politics. Judges ought not to participate in politics to the extent and the degree that other people do, and I have maintained my position, I have maintained my activity, very low profile in the political field ever since I've been judge.
Okay, is there anything that I haven't asked you that you think you might want to respond to, or any area of your life that I haven't really covered thoroughly enough?
Well, I could talk about my experiences in the Navy and the World War and all that sort of kind of thing. No. I would like to say this. In my contacts with society, as a result of my official positions and as a result of my activities in society, I think that the worst thing that has happened is the John Q. Citizen is unwilling to give a little bit of himself to make this a little better country to live in. And I suppose I have two mottos which are somewhat attributed to me, or at least I like to think that these are the things that I choose to expostulate the most. One is, and you see over there, I'm going to post this in my courtroom, none of us can get along without the rest of us. I thoroughly believe about the interdependence of our society and about the need for each of us to help sustain the other. And my activity with young people perhaps is best summed up by this, and of course it shows my selfishness, why I'm interested in youth. Put a little bit of yourself into tomorrow by doing something for a youngster today. I guess that says about what I think, and I suppose I consider myself very honored by the fact that I've been permitted by our community to serve the community. And I know this sounds like a lot of political hogwash, but then again, in the official service which I've had, they've also had me give me the privilege to serve another situations. Just as I look around about the room, I see the Bicentennial Committee and the commission that I worked with and on, and interested in the people that did that, and the various lodges and societies in our community which make ours a community. Okay?
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's good.